Hey, Moshe.
He's a professor at Berkeley. He's in industrial engineering and operations research, as well as electrical engineering and computer science. And he's in the
I-School of Information. Yeah.
Which has something to do with iTunes or.
I wish.
And let me think, there's something else I wanted to tell them about your official accomplishments. You're the director of a laboratory for new media.
That's good, yeah. The Berkeley Center for New Media.
So now, what's Ken been doing all this time? So besides his robotics side and his automation side, which you might know about, what you might not realize is that Ken was also a pioneer in some artistic endeavors. I think one of the first projects that had people interacting over the internet was called a Telegarden, I think. It was a robot that lived for quite a long time on the web, and the robot tended the garden, only it was through collective direction from people visiting the website that were doing this, and there's been a kind of a whole movement that came out of that, and a book that Ken wrote or co-edited or something. And there's a lot of interesting projects. I don't know if you're going to talk about your other side.
No.
The previous visits he has. So if you get a chance to talk to him, you might want to explore all of those. And I think what he's going to talk about today is automation, and I guess maybe that's Ken's most notable contribution. He's really been leading the Robotics and Automation Society in kind of promoting automation to equal standing with robotics. And so that's, is that a question?
Yeah, somebody say.
Oh, I thought, oh, okay. Now, Howie has an announcement.
Yeah, my announcement is Matt has an announcement.
That TG. There's a TG at 5 o'clock.
Yeah, so. But it's for the smiley. That's the emoticon, not the cookie. There's actually a competition, and for those of you who enter the competition, you may know who you are. There's going to be a prize awarded. I think it's like $500 for the smiley Human Technology Award of 2008.
Very good, thank you. Okay, so please join me in welcoming Ken Goldberg.
Thank you, Matt, or as my students call him, Grandpa. I'm going to regret this because it's on videotape, but I'll just tell you very quickly what I was afraid Matt was going to mention, but I'll tell you anyway. It was one of the first real-world applications that I ever had for robotics was when I was a grad student here, and I was with a friend of mine, and we were in his apartment, and in the middle of a party, there was a knock on the door, and it was the police, and we had a bag of tobacco. So we decided that we would very carefully seal it up and put it in the wall, a spot in the wall that they would never look. So they came and they were complaining mostly about the noise, and then they left, and then we went to get the tobacco, and it had fallen behind the wall, like through the back behind it. So we tried it with a mirror and all these other things, we couldn't get to it. So we remembered that we had this robot gripper in the lab. So we went to the lab at like 1 a.m, we got this robot gripper, we basically got this long wire, and we had this camera system. Anyway, we retrieved the tobacco from there. So I consider that a very successful real-world application of of robotics. So, I want to talk to you. What I want to try and cover today is a sort of a mix of things. But the basic message is that the factories are fun, and let me try and make that case. I know some of you believe that already. I want to make, this is just a sort of partial list of people I want to thank, including there's Grandpa there. And I must say, those of you obviously all know Matt. He was a fantastic advisor, and I had a great time during my years here. And it was great to walk around today and just sort of kind of remember all the good old days. So I want to make this sort of distinction between robotics and automation. And we can argue about this, because obviously within the Robotics Institute, you have a lot of opinions. But I wanted to, there's been a lot of discussion at IEEE and other places about this. And one thing we came to was that The word robot comes from Carl Chapek, of course, and it's about 1920 it's coined, and it really is about this idea of, you know, we think of robots as, you know, doing all kinds of interesting things, often in unstructured environments. And then the other word is automation. And this is actually, surprisingly, is a more recent term, coined in 1948. And this is sort of more for predictable environments, where, like factories or labs, where you're going to be doing the same thing over and over again. This is kind of the two flavors of work. And there's a lot of overlap, but that's a way of thinking about the relationship. And as Matt mentioned, so a couple years ago, IEEE decided to create a journal specifically devoted to automation. So the Transactions on Automation Science and Engineering. And there, the emphasis, again, on robotics, I would say one idea is often proof of concept. You want to build something really cool, like many of the things I saw today in visiting a number of labs, and show that something can be done. But the second part of that is when you want to go out and actually have it be done over and over again. And that's where I think you move into the realm of automation, where you're really concerned with efficiency, quality, productivity, and reliability. And then there's also, I want to make the distinction that it's not just factories, that automation is really more broad. It applies to many different things, from everything from, let's say, the fast track for toll booth collecting, to agriculture, security. Right now, a big area is laboratory automation for pharmaceuticals, drug development. Okay, so this slide is meant to say that there's a fundamental relationship, I believe, between design and manufacturing. And I know Matt, you're looking askance at this. Well, we know that this was the iPhone, which I know you have. This was is a very interesting piece of novel design. It wasn't it's not manufactured in the U.S. But I want to argue that the ability to design this product very much depended on the fact that that engineers at Apple know a lot about manufacturing. There's a huge effort where the engineers are very closely aligned. They spend time in the factories. They know what's coming. They know what's possible to produce. So in this case, the multi-point touch screen was something that they figured out they could manufacture reliably and efficiently, and that really led to all the software innovations for the product. So, but it was my point is that if we start to sort of let manufacturing go and sort of Americans decide, well, we just don't care about manufacturing anymore, well, that may work for a little while, but I think ultimately we're going to start also suffering in terms of our ability to design new products. So I want to say that because we know that design is important, and I want to argue that as a result, manufacturing is important too. Okay, and then the other thing I want to make an analogy to is that manufacturing is let me take a step back. Alan Turing, what did Alan Turing do in the field of computation? He took a very messy area that was, computing back in the 20s and 30s was very ad hoc. There were lots of different models, lots of different approaches to it, and he said, let's try and break this down to a very, very simple set of elements, in some sense minimal. Right, so you just have a tape, zeros and ones, and you have a very small set of operations. And he said, let's try and see what we can compute with that. So what was amazing was that he was able to show equivalence to more powerful machines. And the idea of the Turing machine still is very powerful today. We talk about the Turing equivalence. We can, once we have this very simple model, it's clean, we can start proving theorems about it. We can formalize the idea of correctness, completeness, equivalence, and complexity. Now, one of the things that, if you look at this this picture, the model of the Turing machine, it bears some resemblance to the assembly line. And but unfortunately, that's where the similarity ends. The assembly lines, and this is an old one, but actually modern assembly lines are pretty similar, are not clean and elegant at all. There are oftentimes all kinds of loose ends, parts, even automated assembly lines where there's no humans in the picture, are often put together by lots of different ad hoc techniques. Now, not to say that those techniques aren't brilliant, and in fact they often are. There's, as Matt's pointed out, if you want to really go to a factory and sit down and watch some time. And it's fascinating to see all the, especially an automated assembly line, to watch all the different methods that have been developed to be able to produce products reliably over and over again. But what I want to argue is that these assembly line, that what we need essentially now is to do what Turing did for computing, and we need to do that for manufacturing. So in a sense, put the Turing into manufacturing. And so I want to argue that, I want to give you some examples from work that that I've been doing with my students in my group, in particularly two areas, which are part feeding and fixturing. And then I'll end with some related work in open problems. So so let's go back just to the broader question of manufacturing, that currently the design, now I'm talking not the design of the products, but the design of the factory itself, the assembly line, is very much of a black art. We know the geometry, that's usually, we have CAD models available. And we know that we're going to be producing the same thing over and over again, and that the design of the parts are not going to change very often. And what we really care about in a factory is cost, throughput, and reliability. So what I want to argue for is this idea of algorithmic automation, that we can define, formally define the kind of products or components that we're going to be putting together. So we have a class of admissible inputs, say polyhedra, convex or concave, or maybe algebraic surfaces. But we have to have some clean definition of what's allowed as input. We have to have a set of what are the admissible operators, what operations or commands that we can perform, and or controls. And then we need, what we want to do is have as output for an algorithm, you're given a specification of, say, an assembly, and the output will be a set of operations that will achieve that assembly, or a negative report, namely that, well, with that set of operations, it can't be done. And then what we'd also like to do is have some model of complexity. So how will that algorithm perform as a function of the complexity of the input? So if you give it a full Boeing 787, it's obviously going to take longer to compute than an iPhone. But we want to have some model of how it's going to scale with input. OK, so I'm going to focus on these two problems. And the first one really grew out of work that I did here when I was a grad student. So I call it's algorithmic part feeding. Now, feeding is another word for orienting. And the idea is that you have a bunch of parts that usually get delivered at the factory in bags or boxes. So there's lots of them jumbled up. And what you need to do, though, to do something useful with them is you need to get them oriented so that you can then put them to use. So it's been argued that a lot of the time in factories is the setup time for a new factory is devoted to just getting the parts in the right place. This part feeding problem. And one of the techniques that's been around for over a century is this idea of the vibratory bowl feeder. How many of you have heard of those? OK, good. Did you see it in class, or is it you just know it? Class? OK.
Matt talks about it
all the time. All right, good. Glad to hear that. I mean, these are very cool. We love these bowl feeders. I mean, they're great to watch. They work beautifully. The problem is that they take a while to set up. So you're given a part, and you have to make the bowl, the track, that will feed the part. And that is where the tricky part is. It's really there are experts who do it, but there's not an algorithmic approach to designing bowl feeders. And what we'd like to have is a universal part feeder, or you might call a universal turning machine. See how many puns I can make on Turing's name today. But here's the idea. So you want to be able to specify a geometry as input. So you have your CAD model, and then you have some black box. You feed some software into it, and the part comes out oriented uniquely on the output. So there's a lot of work that this draws from related to, this is related to many problems in robotics. Much of the work really originated with Matt's dissertation and a number of his colleagues and associates that were contemporaries, many of them here, that looked at pushing and squeezing operations, also a variety of primitive components like toppling and pulling, tapping and dropping, wobbling, rolling, and vibrating. So by looking at those individual components, there's lots of insights that we can get to the specific mechanics of these different kinds of aspects. One of which is, and then there's also people have looked at the feeder hardware itself. How could you make that modular? How could you have some software-driven components in the feeders? And there's also a lot of work that's out there in the literature, in the sort of manufacturing automation literature, that is sort of, Boothroyd is an example where you have basically lots of libraries, guidebooks, catalogs of parts, and say, well, if it looks like this, you might want to try this, which are very helpful. They're kind of heuristics, but they're not algorithmic. And then there's been some work with simulation of feeders. That's a nice step because it's sort of a human in the loop. You say, okay, well, here, if we can simulate this, we can sort of, by trial and error, try and find a solution. And then there's also been some heuristic designs work, particularly a guy named Kane, who developed a set of visualization tools for looking at the configuration space of parts in feeder tracks. So, so I'm going to describe my approach, which was using a very simple, extremely simple piece of hardware. That's the parallel jaw gripper, and here's how it works. We'll just use this rectangular part as an example. So the jaws come down, and here's a trace. So the jaws are going to come down and squeeze the part, and then it'll be aligned horizontally. And then they'll squeeze. The jaws will rotate and then squeeze again, and the part will be aligned this way. And the idea is that no matter how the part starts out, it's always going to end up uniquely oriented. So here's a simulation of this idea. So now the thing to note is that the initial orientation of the parts is variable, is random essentially, and but the output, the final orientation, is always unique. The other thing to note is that the jaws aren't doing any sensing. They're just blindly opening and closing. So someone has called this oblivious manipulation or sensorless manipulation. So, and actually, that's what defines a lot of what happens in factories. It's very reliable because you don't have a sensor that will break down. You just go through these operations blindly, and parts come out the other end. Well, the question you're probably thinking is, well, okay, that's cool, but does that work for an arbitrary polygon? And so,
yeah, that doesn't place the part in a particular place, though. It could be laterally translated, right?
That's right. So there's a final uncertainty in the final position of it. But then you could say have something else that would another constraint that would allow it to finally drop onto something and then be transported off of it. But yeah, where you are along the gripper axis, that one last dimension is not resolved. Let's see. So let's first start out with a mechanical problem. Wedging is a problem with parallel jaws. If you have a part like this, a polygonal part, it's possible that you can end up with a wedging condition where you have, because of the friction between these two, the friction cone, the points of contact create a line, and if that line lies within the friction cones, the part can become wedged. And there's a whole range of orientations where that can happen. So the problem is that now you have a continuous set of possible outcomes after this first grasp. What we'd like to look at is a finite set. Where you have at least one edge aligned with the jaws. So I worried about this problem for a while, and I was trying to think of ways to resolve it. And one of the ideas you might think of is a mechanical solution, which is to pour grease on it. And I remember Ben and I had a discussion about, we thought, that's okay, because it's sort of like grabbing a bar of soap. And you know, it will slide into position. Well, that's good, except it's messy, and when you try and lift the jaw up, you know, the part will slip away. So what you really want to do is control. You want to reduce friction in one direction, but not the other. So here was the idea, is to put a passive linear bearing on one jaw. And this was Merrick first. It was a conversation I had with him in the lounge during a TG, where we came up with this idea of putting a parallel jaw, a passive bearing on one jaw. So here's the idea, is that if you close the jaws now, the bearing translates off to the right, and the part snaps into one of its stable orientations. And the nice thing about this is you can put a high friction material here and here so that the part is stably held, when you want to lift it off the table. And the other thing, I worried about was, well, after this is off to the side and you pick it up, how do you recenter it? And so I thought about magnets and all these complicated things. But the answer was really just to put a rubber band around it. And the reason is that the gripping force always can overcome the spring force of the rubber band. So you always will. That's not a problem to have a rubber band. The only problem that introduced with the rubber band is now when you want to let go, the band will cause the part to sort of spring back, right, or kind of lose its orientation. And the solution to that was another mechanical idea, which was to put some grease in the jaws. Because that grease creates a viscous friction, so then it moves back slowly when you let go. So anyway, so we'll put that aside now that we've made a reasonable mechanical approach to saying that this assumption is fair, that the contacting surfaces are effectively frictionless. And now the problem statement from a computational point of view is you're given the description of the planar part. And I want to point out here that we're always going to be just treating the convex hull of the part. So we can't, if there's a concavity in the part, they're invisible to these parallel jaws, so we can't see that. And what we want to do is find the shortest sequence of gripper actions that are guaranteed to orient the part, or report that no such sequence exists. And then we have some assumptions. Again, this is not solving the whole problem by any means. It's just a planar version of the problem for this class of polygonal parts. We're also going to assume that the part is rigid, that there's no inertial forces, so we do things quasi-statically. And as I mentioned, we're only going to orient it up to symmetry in the convex hull. So here's the way the algorithm works. And again, I'm going to use this to demonstrate, but you'll see that it can be generalized. We first define something called the width function. So this basically is, if you sweep two parallel lines in from infinity, and you just have them just make contact with the jaw, with the object, what'll happen is, let's say the object will, the width function will start out at some when the part is at this orientation, the width function will be, say, at some value. And then as you start rotating the part, the width function will grow up to some point when it's maximally aligned, and then it will shrink down when it's down at another stable point, then it will grow up and shrink down again, etc. And it will be symmetric, this function is a period of pi, because of the symmetry in the gripper. But we can also think of this as a potential function. So with these quasi-static assumptions, if you grasp the part in some intermediate orientation, it's going to basically follow a path to the nearest local minimum. Now, we don't really care about the shape of this thing, this piecewise sinusoidal curve. It's easy to compute, but we don't really need that. All we need to know is that, hey, if I grabbed it anywhere between this range, it will end up at this orientation pi. So I take this function and I create, it has a mapping onto this function on the torus, mapping from the initial orientation, theta, to a final orientation, s of theta. And so it says if you started out anywhere in this range and squeezed once, you'd end up at this final orientation. And if you happen to be here, you'd be done. But now what we want to do is we want to back chain. So just as in many applications in robotics where you do a search strategy, you backchain from the goal. Here's the idea: is that you basically construct this step function, look at the widest single step. So we're going to do this in a greedy fashion. We find the widest single step, and we say, okay, well, if we were within this range of orientations initially, and we squeezed the gripper, we'd end up here, and we'd be done. But now we have to work backward. Now this is going to become our target or our pre-image. So now we take another copy of this squeeze function, and we now look for a placement of that pre-image on the vertical axis such that it will grab a larger pre-image on the horizontal axis. So essentially place this at different points and find this image. Now once we reach a period of symmetry, the width of this green interval is a period of pi, we're done because we can't go any further. And we've started out anywhere within this range. Once we squeeze once, we'll either end up here or here, which are these two. And these are 90 degrees apart. That's small enough within that range, can be moved and placed right under this step, which then will come out in that unique final step. So the trick then is, once you've done this set of operations, all you need to know is the relative angle of this and match that and this. And that gives you the gripper angle you need for each of the steps. Now, I won't go into all the detail on this. But this can also be generalized to break the symmetry by using pushing. So if you know the part's center of mass, you could create something analogous to the width function called the radius function. And the radius function basically is related to the height of the center of mass. And you see that this is not doesn't have period of symmetry. But it also generates a piecewise constant step function. You can compose these two functions to come up with a push-squeeze function that's, again, piecewise constant. And then you can apply the algorithm onto that, come up with the sequence of intervals, and then you get this three-step plan. So this is showing you these different traces of the same scenario and for this part. And I'll just show you this one. This is really old. This is looking up through a piece of glass from the manipulation lab from circa 1990 when we were still using VHS. So it's a really not a great image. But we're now at this stage. And you'll see the gripper close. And here you see the jaw. If you look carefully, the jaw will pop over to a little bit there. And then it will orient us. Okay. So now I want to show you that an implementation of this. We made this just a couple years ago, and it's online. So if you want to try it yourself, you can. On my website, there's a link to it. And here's the idea, just to show you that it's fairly fast. So I'm going to draw a part here. And this part has concavities, but again, remember, I'm not going to be able to orient it up. I'm only going to be able to orient it up to symmetry in the convex hull. Okay, there's a part. Then this is the width function, and that's the step function comes out of it, and then that's the solution that's found by the algorithm. So, see what. Okay, good. I always worried this is going to bomb in the middle of some very important talk like this one. All right, but now we're able to do some things with this, which were we could prove completeness, that's a result I'm most proud of, which was that we were able to prove this would work for any polygonal part, and then we could also show correctness. That the algorithm finds the shortest plan, and we can characterize the complexity, which is fairly straightforward. There were a number of extensions that I did with students and collaborators after I left Carnegie Mellon. One was to look at stochastically optimal plans, where you had some probability distribution over the initial range of orientations, so you can take advantage of that. We could also extend this to non-zero friction, because we found that you could just avoid the non-zero friction regions. This was a result that was joint with Frank van der Stappen. We were able to show that the time complexity of this actually depended on the aspect ratio of the part, because the bad parts look very much like circles. They're just like polygonal approximations to circles. Let's say a gear with one tooth missing. That's the part that requires order n steps. But we found that if the part most parts don't look like that. They have some geometric eccentricity, and then we could show that the number of steps was a constant. Question?
Yeah. So I was wondering for your complexity theorem.
Yeah.
Do you mean that the convex hull has n sides, or just n sides?
No, convex hull. Okay. Yeah. Yes. And then we did some other things where we looked at pulling points. We found a dual to this, which is that if you have a part like a cookie cutter where it's concavity, a polygonal concavity, you could pull the part with a point jaw and use the same algorithm to orient it. And then this was work with a student, Anil Rao, where we generalized it to algebraic curves. So we could not only deal with linear segments, polygonal parts, but we could also have algebraic curves on the contour. Basically, the trick there was being able to generalize to develop the width function and the step function. But once we had that, we could apply the same operation, the same algorithm. And then this was a work that Mike Peshkin was doing over here in the ME department right around the same time. He was looking at this idea of using fences to orient parts. And so I'll just run this one more time. You can watch really carefully. It's hard to see, but these are a bunch of parts in different orientations. But they just come down and they hit these fences, and that the they'll all come out the same way. And the trick is, to come up with the fence angles. And it turned out that Mike was doing this using a heuristic technique where he was just sampling fence angles. And after some thinking about it, we realized that we could map the this algorithm for feeding parts with a parallel jaw gripper to exactly compute fence angles. Okay, so now, since then, there's been a lot of work where there's been ideas about being able, for example, to use vibrating plates to create something analogous to the motion of the parallel jaws. In other words, parts will line up along this axis of vibration. And we did this in a MEMS context for microscale parts. And also it's been done on a macro scale with flexible vibration. But this is work that Kevin Lynch did with his students recently on vibrating plates. I don't know, has he presented this here? It's really beautiful. He basically instrumented a plate with a bunch of speakers, speaker coils. And he's able to manipulate the plate such that these two parts can be oriented, not only oriented, but then he can mate them so that the forces are localized to the position of the plate. So it looks like magic. Stop action animation. You can do anything with that. No. All right. Now, you may be thinking, well, OK, that's great. That's 2D, but it's not, that's no good for real parts or in three dimensions. So we did do some work here. And one idea was we had talked with Adept Technology, which is a big robotics company. And they were facing this part feeding problem. And their idea was to use their camera and a robot arm to pick up parts as they came out on a conveyor belt and reorient them. So they were going to manually intervene, but they wanted to be able to do this, again, in software, so that when you change the part, all you had to do was change the software. The problem was that with this four-axis arm, SCARA-type arm, you can't do that. You can't pick this part up and put it in there. You don't have that degree of freedom. So one of the things that we came up with was the idea of putting a pivoting axis on the tip of the jaws. And it's analogous to the translating axis, passive translating axis, of the parallel jaw gripper. But here you're using the a pivoting axis. And the idea is that if you pick the part up off center, you're using gravity to cause the part to reorient so that its center of mass lies directly below the grasp axis. And then you could take a part from this orientation and this orientation. So then we started thinking about how we could generalize that. And we came up with the idea that you could do for a polyhedral part, basically what you knew where it started, its initial direction, and you knew where you wanted it to end up. And if you take the cross product of that, that gives you a direction. Then you look for a place where you want that axis to be, that will basically be stable on the two edges in that direction. So we could compute that. And then the nice thing is that, yes?
I can follow that.
But the two, well, you start out here and you want to end up here, right?
Right.
Right. So you basically want the part to rotate through this angle, right? So you want to hold it here, in an orthogonal direction.
What defines these first two axes?
One is it's sitting on this orientation, and you want it to be sitting at this orientation.
Okay.
Right. So I need to get it from here over to there in this case. So that means I want to hold it along the cross product of those two.
Okay.
So well, that gives me a direction, but now I need to find a position of those that would be stable, essentially. And so we can compute that. And so if this is a set of initial stable orientations, and then this is the final, again, the same set, but the final orientations, this will this algorithm will then tell you where grip points that will achieve the transformation from 2 to 1. Etc. But you also note that there's certain ones that can't be done. Like you can't pick this part up and flip it all the way around to get over there. But you can do it in two steps. You could go from 4 to 3 and then from 3 to 6. So this matrix is helpful for being able to reorient parts using that method. Now, when we were working with Adept, they were very interested in computing the throughput of this kind of feeder. And actually, I think Matt has a. Do you still have this in your lab? One of these feeders. The idea was you have these multiple belts. They're backlit. You have a camera overhead, and your parts are basically circulating through, over and over again. And as you identify them, you're picking them up and reorienting them. And one of the questions was, well, how often am I going to? Is our parts going to arrive in a position in an orientation that I'm able to pick up? And that we got interested in this, what we ended up calling the pose statistics, estimating pose statistics issue. And again, this is just like the most basic thing you learn in probability, right? You start with a coin. And what's the probability it lands on each of the two faces? Well, because of symmetry, it's 50-50. Or a die is 1 in 6. But what about an arbitrary part? So you have some weird thing. You don't know what's the probability it's going to land on each of the different faces. So we did some work on that. And I actually think this is a very, there's a lot more that could be done. We made some progress, but I think this is kind of a really ready for a good student to take on as a, to really to take this much further. But we had this test part, and we ran it through this conveyor belt system something like 1,000 times. So we had lots of data, and the camera system was telling us the orientations. And so this told us the distribution of the part. And now we wanted to come up with a model that would just take a CAD model of this and compute or come up with a distribution that was consistent with what we were seeing physically. And so this shows you the different models we had. You know, this is okay; it's somewhat close, but it's not really great. this was running a simulator. This was our quasi-static predictor, which was just doing something very simple: projecting the center of mass out to a sphere, and then looking at the relative size of all the different faces on that sphere. And then this was called perturbed quasi-static. So we could then start to think about the dynamics, because parts that aren't too stable will tend to land, but then topple over. So again, I think there's a lot more to be done there. We have a paper on it that I think started the work, but really there's a lot more to do. There's other groups have looked at how to generalize the idea of fences to three dimensions. And then there's this idea of traps. The other piece of the vibratory bowl is traps. So you have the part comes along, and there's a cutout in the track. And that causes the part to fall back in. Now, generally, we just think of these rectangular traps. But we wanted to think if we could come up with some theoretical model, an algorithm to design the traps. So here, again, is the idea. You have a polygonal part. You want to find a polygonal trap, a cutout in the floor. So as the part passes along, it can only pass in one unique orientation, and all other orientations get rejected. And so we found one thing is that the part center of mass can be hanging out over the trap, and the part can still be stable. That's not a problem. The trick is, as long as there's a tripod of support points around the center of mass, the part is still what we call safe. So we could very quickly compute whether a pose of the part is safe. But now what we really want to do is we want to be able to compute over a path of the part as the part sweeps across this this polygonal trap. So that this is, again, just an analysis. You're given a part, you're given a trap, and you want to know, will it survive in that orientation? And so by using a line sweeping version of the static case, in other words, there's a number of events. As you pass over, edges either are added or deleted, or vertices intersect or stop intersecting. And you basically use that to come up with an efficient algorithm to check whether the part is safe during its entire transition. So that is OK. Again, it's not a synthesis, but it was a way of looking at, given that if you had a hunch of a trap, you could test whether it was going to be safe over it. We also did some work on some classes of traps. So we looked at traps that were essentially rectangular, and we were able to prove to develop some algorithms that would basically come up with trap designs for rectangular forms. And then some others have extended that with non-rectangular shapes. We looked at the other aspect of bowl feeders are putting these little obstacles in the way, what you might call pins. So how could you put an arrangement of pins down that would cause the part to rotate into a unique final orientation? And this was joint work with Kevin Lynch. So just to visualize that, the idea is that you can see here that you put these pins down so that the part, as they come along, gets passively rotated into a unique final orientation. And then the newest idea we've had in this direction is something we call blades. And this is a work with Frank Vanderstappen and his student Ono. And here's the idea. This sort of combines the idea of fences with pins and with traps all into one primitive. And the primitive is what we call a blade. And here this will show you the a blade in action. So the parts are coming down, and you see how they react to the blade. The blade, the first part is sort of like a fence. It rotates the part. And then the second part causes the part to either be rejected or passed along. So they combine both those functionality. They both transfer or convert the part, and they also reject it. So a blade is a primitive that has three parameters. We can characterize it with a height, a width, and an angle. And so what we want is an algorithmic approach saying, give me the polyhedral part and the center of mass, and then give me a blade or a set of blades that will pass that part in only one unique orientation. So we have to make some assumptions, just as we did before, that the we know the part shape, et cetera, that the motion is quasi-static. We also make a pretty strong assumption that parts are singulated. So and by the way, this is another nice problem, which is if the parts are not singulated, how do you singulate them? So it's sort of detangling parts. That is a beautiful problem, and as far as I know, no one has ever addressed it. So we just start out with the part geometry. We know what its shape is, and we also can, it's easy to compute what are all the stable poses of the part in the plane, and the stable poses again where the part is in the plane and in contact with the track rail or wall. And now, for each of those, we want to do an analysis to determine how is the part going to come into contact with the blade. So, and this depends on the relative position of the center of mass, how the blade, how the part in the initial orientation reacts to the fence at angled area, and but all of that is determines once we know where it starts out, we can determine how it's going to end up. So, a particular blade is a point in a three-dimensional blade space. So, if you take height, width, and angle, you have these points. And what you want to do is essentially look for criticalities. So there's going to be a critical width where, for example, that part's going to fall off, right? And that that is that anywhere, if the width is smaller than this, the part is safe. And at this critical width, anything above it, the part's going to fall off. And then what we're going to do is use that to define a surface in that space, a critical surface. So for a given one particular pose of the part, that defines a surface in this space, and it says anything below the surface, any blade below the surface is going to let the part pass, and anything above is going to reject the part. So that's a critical surface for one pose. What I'm going to do then is compute the surface for all the poses, all the finite number of stable poses, and stable poses. And then what I want to look for is something called a one-level surface, which is I want to look for pockets that are below one of these surfaces and above all the rest, because those are going to be areas that those are going to be blades, those are going to correspond to blades that will pass that one orientation and reject all the others. And so, and this is an area of computational geometry that's pretty hairy, but there are some nice complexity bounds associated with being able to solve problems like this. So we are able to come up with an algorithm that's able to output that is able to compute these exactly and find the set of blades that will feed the part. We also have built a prototype of this, and I'll show you, this is a video. Is it going to work? Let's see. Come on. Oh, it's just going to take a second to load. But there's a simulation above using Cosmos, and then below, let's see. Let's see if it'll work. Below is an actual is a video of the real thing. So if I could get this to work, it would show that these are doing the same thing. But for some reason, it does not want to cooperate.
Shake the computer.
Yeah, that could work. I want to shake it right now. That's a bummer because it actually. But anyway, the behavior is very 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 similar, at least in this configuration. Okay, so now I'm going to shift gears to fixturing. And this is another basic primitive in manufacturing, where there's a lot of opportunity for research. The way fixtures are made now, at least there's many different classes of fixtures, but there are lots of problems with them. Again, very ad hoc. People put them together on a sort of just to solve a problem. And they're often these dedicated, very complicated, expensive machines that are, and this is say in an auto factory, that are essential to the production of cars, but there's not a good theoretical model around them. Now, I looked with Randy Brost and I, collaborated, to look at a particular model, what we call modular fixturing. And here's the idea, was that there's actually a few companies who make these things they call erector set tooling. And it's sort of, you come out with a lattice of holes and a bunch of basic primitive objects, is you get a kit, basically. And then the idea is, OK, given a part, you put these pieces together from the kit. So that's narrowed the field, the range of possibilities dramatically. Now the question is, given a new part, how do you, can you come up with a configuration of these components? So, and in particular, we want to draw on the science of form closure, which Matt taught me, and immobility, which is a very nice way of characterizing, if you, even with zero friction, if you make a contact, these four contacts will completely constrain the part kinematically. And in fact, there's some new results that, a new model set, you can actually characterize second-order immobility, and you can get 3 points. But the question is, can we synthesize fixtures for a given part? And there's lots of different toolkits out there. I don't want to. There's a number of them that are commercially available. But we concentrated on this one that was, in some sense, really simple. We said we're going to just use three of the primitive locators, so three posts, and then one clamp, and the clamp is attached to the lattice. It can move along the lattice directions, but it can slide off lattice, and it can push this clamp to hold the part securely. So that's an example of a solution for that blue part. So the problem statement is, you're given the description of the blue part. In this case, there are concavities. And what you want to do is find a fixture, so it's a combination of three pins and one clamp that will hold the part in form closure, or a report that there is no such. Is no such fixture. And now we make this is a reasonable assumption here, is that we're sort of conservatively assuming that everything's frictionless. In fact, there is friction, but that's only going to help us. So here's I'll just show you the example of the algorithm with, again, an example part. This is, say, a glue gun. The first thing we do is a very typical technique that's, that everybody in robotics does, is you want to grow the part and shrink the obstacles. In this case, the posts, by the diameter of the post. So we just do a Minkowski sum operation to expand the part. Then we also have these regions in red that are stay-out zones. So the designer might say, well, don't put a contact here or here or here, because I want to do an operation or assembly there. So we can do that, restrict those areas. And what we're left with is a set of edges. And these are the candidate edges where I'm able to make contact with the these are now going to be point locators. Now, the way we approach it was, we said, well, let's just pick sort of any two edges, call it A and B, and think about, well, where, and without loss of generality, we'll put one locator on A, say, put that at the origin. And now, where are all the places I can put the second locator on B? So, and this is, I think, this can also be improved, but what we did was, we said, well, let's just look at the minimum maximum distance between those two locators. And that's going to define an annulus on that, over that lattice. And basically, we only consider locators that are within that annulus. In fact, because of symmetry, we only need to consider one quadrant. And then what we do is, once we have one set of configurations, we choose a pair of one locator here and one locator here. We then repeat this with another pair of edges. And then we, again, take this intersecting annuli, and it says, this is a possible set of candidate locations for the third locator. And so on. So the and once we have three locators, it's very easy to basically go around and compute possible clamp locations. So I'll just show you an implementation of this. Unless this computer is going to really die on me. Come on. This worked a minute ago. Okay, wait a second. Mm-hmm. Here we are. Okay, so what I'll do is to start a new part, we can just draw a part in this window. And again, this is also online if you want to try it. And you close the polygon, and then you compute the fixtures. Okay, so then that shows you a solution. But in this case, we've computed, this part, for example, only has one fixture found. Usually there's a number of them. Anyway, so that's a solution. And then what you can do is you can put, you can also visualize the reaction forces so that if you, as a machinist, you might be able to look at this and say, well, here's, I'm going to be applying a cross-cut operation or something like that, and I want to understand how is the part going to react to those forces. And then usually, for most parts, there's more than one solution. So then you can just click it through and find and try alternate solutions until you find one that you like. Okay. Great. Okay. So this was a complete algorithm. We could characterize it in terms of the number of edges and the diameter of the part, characterize the time complexity of this. Also, there was a result that I'm proud of, a negative result, that we were able to show that actually there's a whole class of parts that can't be fixtured on a regular lattice. And that's not so obvious. I mean, obviously, small parts are going to fall through the cracks, but even for parts of arbitrary diameter, we could construct parts that won't, that can't be fixtured. There was a number of other results that that came out of Frank van der Stappen and Mark Overmars out of Utrecht. In this area, this is a different problem that we looked at with. This is with a student, this is another PhD student, Mike Zhang, at Berkeley. And if you could see from what was going on there, the idea is that these draws are very weird looking. But the idea is that as you passively close them around a part and cause the part to rotate into a desired final configuration. So the design of those draws was another thing we looked at. So two more quick topics, and then we'll open up for some questions. The other thing is we looked at this idea of another class of fixtures that we called unilateral fixtures. And the motivation here was particularly for the auto industry, in this case Ford Motor Company. They wanted to be able to grab parts like an auto body side panel or something from the inside so that they could come around from the other side and do the welding or some kind of operation on it. So they wanted to the idea was to make use of the concavities in the sheet metal. So once you had these concavities, you could build these, we came up with this model of these sort of twin conical grippers. And the idea was that if you put these grippers in and then you pull outward, you could create a rigid constraint that was, as I mentioned earlier, was analogous to the form closure. And so there's been other work in fixture design, particularly Mike Wong, who also graduated from here. And I won't go into a lot of detail, but we were able to show that given the set of concave sections within the part, I went to bed at 2 in the morning last night, so it's catching up to me. Anyway, we were able to come up with an algorithm that would generate unilateral fixtures. And the last thing I want to mention is D-space. Here, we looked at the issue of holding deformable objects. And because many objects in the industry, especially, are deformable. So you're trying to put things together, but they move. They're flexible in some way. Sheet metal being one case, but there's many others. And and so there has been some work in sort of planning with deformable objects like strings or sheets. And in fact, this came out of some work that we're doing, which I won't talk about today, but we're also working on surgery simulation and motion planning for medical applications. And so we were doing some work with FEM. And one of my students who was working on the grasping work was sitting next to the other student. And he said, hey, maybe I could start applying FEM to grasping. So. Here is the idea: is that how do you even define something like a form closure or a fixture for a deformable part? Because you can always put contacts, but then by deforming the part, it can always get away. So what he came up with, Gopal Krishnan came up with, was, well, let's put a mesh. Let's define a mesh around the part, a triangular mesh, And then let's define something like a C space around the node displacement. So these are the nodes. So we call this the deformation space, or the D space. And the idea is that every node now has 2 degrees of freedom. It can move around. And we want to say this is analogous to all the higher dimensional configuration space that you're familiar with. So here's the idea is that as you move the node around, this third node around, it creates, in the D space, there's a different range of orientations, or sorry, a different range of positions. But you're particularly interested in things that break the topology of the mesh. So you want to essentially avoid these configurations that cause the mesh to the triangulation to change its topology. So this is essentially an obstacle in the D space. You can also think about obstacles in the physical space here, and so whenever you have those, they can also be represented in the deformation space. So you have both obstacles and topological constraints, and then what you end up with is this is the essentially free space, if you will. The space that's of allowable deformations. Now, the next step was to think about the energy associated with these different points in the D space. And we can use some fairly straightforward method from FEM, which is we just apply a linear stiffness matrix, and we can look at the potential energy of each configuration or point in the D space. And so then, this is just a projection, but on the higher dimensional space, you end up with these local minima, which again is similar to what we started with talking about the parallel jaw gripper. And so a local minimum here is kind of like this. It says, well, if you're just letting the part spring back with passively in spring energy, it'll kind of spring into this orientation, so that or this configuration, so that even if you perturb it a little bit locally, it will be in this capture zone, this local minimum. So it will return to its unique orientation. And then what we want to ask is, well, what would it take to really get this out of there, to pull it out? Well, you'd have to basically, if you're happily sitting here, you'd have to get enough energy to get it up out of there so it would move into a new configuration. So that gives us a measure here of how much, how the quality, if you will, of that configuration. So just to give you an illustration, this is informed closure. And so is this, but this one requires a lot more deformation. So it requires more energy in this case to get the part to escape. Okay. So again, I'm trying to sort of give just a quick overview of these things to give you a flavor of this area. There's really a number of other really beautiful results in this area of grasping, and there's also work in caging, which I won't go into now, but is a just placement of polygonal points that will cause a part to be able to unable to escape. People have looked at the idea of sorting parts on conveyor belts. There's a whole host of work that's come out of this. I'm happy to tell you about later. But again, these all have what's in common to this, and really it's grown out of, I think, out of really an approach that was pioneered here at Carnegie Mellon by Matt and his colleagues, is this idea of what we call algorithmic automation, that you clearly define inputs, define the operations, and then you can generate algorithms that have nice formal properties. So as I mentioned, I think there's still many problems here. We haven't solved this, the feeder design or the fixturing design yet. There's lots to do. Tangling, as I mentioned, people have no way of modeling tangling behavior, even just two parts sitting on top of each other. And I think it would be really interesting to be able to do that. Tolerancing, I mean, in everything I've mentioned so far, we've assumed that you know the orientation of the shape of the part. So dealing with uncertainty in that is a really nice problem. Another one that I think would be fantastic, and this relates to some of the work that Ralph is doing, is laying out the assembly line, given the steps you need to take. So there's been some work on assembly design. And then this one, I think, is where really the future lies, which is in redesigning the parts and the design of the products for manufacturing. So remember, they're not just handed to you. Oftentimes, you have some choice in how the shape of the part is determined. So could we come up with some nice designs of the parts that would be particularly amenable to manufacturing of them? So I want to say that there's a grand challenge. And if you look back, in around 1770 was the invention of interchangeable parts, right, with the idea of muskets and for guns. And then it was about 140 years later that we had assembly lines up here. And so I want to say, hopefully within the next 140 years, we'll get to this point, which is where essentially you're applying the idea of interchangeable parts to the assembly line itself and doing this algorithmically. So can we take the legacy, the sort of approach, where someone like Turing will come along and say, here's a way of thinking about it. Let's clean this up. Let's think about this really nicely and elegantly. And then from then on, we'll have nice formal models. So that's my biggest message to you. Don't give up on factories. There's still a lot of there's lots of interesting problems to be had there. So thank you. So yes, Chris.
It seems to me that all your algorithms start from scratch and figure out what to do. But it seems also seems to me, especially when you consider that real parts are not rigid, and, you know, all sorts of funky stuff happens, that this is a really excellent domain for plan refinement, where the original plan comes from, say, an expert human being, or some learning mumble or something.
Mm-hmm. So I see. You would start out with something, and then you would say, okay, how do we tweak it, or how would we refine the plan?
New part. You say, oh, this is similar to something I did 50 years ago in the M&M Mars manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I had a solution there, and now I'm going to refine it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, one of the things is that certainly there's a nice challenge in just coming up with a similarity metric, right, between two scenarios, right? Well, how am I going to search through my prior library to figure out that this is the right, similar, the closest previous scenario? But there's some hope for that, because as I mentioned, Boothroyd has these catalogs, right? And again, all that stuff is incredibly ad hoc. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. It's amazing, because there's books and books, and they cost like $1,000 to buy. Very expensive, but these catalogs, and you know, it's not, there's no rigor to it.
Well, I resent that.
What?
There's an incredible genius to it.
Mm.
And especially if you look at something like how they wrap candy bars, which I at one point got to see. They have rolls of candy bar covering, and they have basically very long tubes of chocolate. And they're shooting out this tube. They're flying out the paper to wrap it with all really high speed.
Yeah.
And you can see it sort of comes around very naturally. And then they got the chopper thing to make it into things. And you know, they make huge numbers of candy bars very quickly.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I don't.
It's genius.
Oh yeah, no, I agree. It's genius.
There's nothing non-rigorous about it. It really works.
Well, what do I want to say? Okay, not formalizable. All right, it's not formalized.
True.
But that's true. I mean, listen, art is like that too, right? I mean, there's genius artwork and films and projects that, you know, and I don't think we'll ever, hopefully, never have a mathematical algorithms for producing them. And I agree with you. Actually, I think that comes to the point that, you know, there's some really great solutions that are out there. And particularly the chocolate is a good case where they shape the part, right? They carefully control the shape to make these things amenable to wrapping and other things. And you're right. I mean, another thing that's interesting and is you know, I think in that regard is that, you know, maybe you just say, I'm going to only deal with parallel pipettes, you know, all kinds of just rectangular shapes with different aspect ratios. But what would be a set of primitives? What could I do with that? And by the way, human designers are going to be very good. I think they could make really interesting objects from those things. But you would have, let's say, the factory that could handle any kind of combination of parallel pipettes. Well, that would be an interesting result. So, you know, I think, you know, I don't want to sound as if this, what's going on in factories today, is anything less than absolutely brilliant. But it could be done so much better.
Well, in some sense, electronics manufacturer is your parallel pipette, because they handle a set of parts,
yep,
and they're all set.
Yeah, and actually, it's a great point. I should have said, Electronics is a good example where they do very carefully constrain the set of things you can do, and that allows you to say do design rule checking, which is a nice example, right? Where at the design stage, something is always checking whether something is feasible in manufacturing, and as soon as you violate that, you get a red zone and says don't do this, and the designer says oh okay, and they back off, and saves them a lot of time later in the fab line, right? And that was so another idea, and maybe this relates to your point of meeting the designer halfway, is some kind of design rule checking that could be done at the CAD level. That's a really interesting direction. Great. Yes?
So you showed us some techniques for manipulating parts that are sensorless, but how much algorithmic leverage can you buy with just a few parts? Like, say, if I add one brake beam,
yeah.
How much simpler is the problem?
Good question.
Why didn't you ever think of that?
I didn't show it, but actually, it's a great question. So it turns out, yes, you can do a lot with, let's say, here's another related problem is, I'm just going to have one LED and a detector. So I'm going to just be able to detect when something breaks along one axis in space. The question, an algorithmic question might be, where do I place that axis optimally, right, to do a check? And there's a nice question, which is just simply tolerance checking, right? I have a part with all these tolerances. I'm going to drop the part into, say, a corner box. Like Matt came up with this great idea. You drop it into the box, and then you want to place these light beams in the optimal way that will check if the part is good or not, right? That's a really nice problem. And the same thing could be done with, you know, the parallel jaws, where you actually relax this a little bit, where you can measure the distance between the two jaws, right? That's easy. You know, most grippers have that built in as some kind of potentiometer. So yeah, you use that information. And in fact, we showed that you could orient parts very quickly by just grasping them and measuring that distance. In fact, you could differentiate between a whole group of parts very quickly just with a parallel jaw gripper, grasping it once or twice randomly. And then using a Bayesian technique, you could determine what the part was. So yeah, I think you're right. I don't want to push. I think you would agree with me, but that you know, the sensorless is kind of one extreme, but we're not kind of purists in the sense that we don't believe in sensors at all. But then as you want to start introducing simpler sensors, again, while you can still formalize what you can do with them. So I think there's a lot, to answer your question, there's a lot that could be done there. Ralph? Oh, I didn't show you Ralph's picture. You know what's weird? Oh, no. I wasn't going to show you that. I had a picture of Ralph's project on here. I was going to, it somehow must have went in that glitch. But Ralph's work is another example, I think, that I wanted to mention, which is very relevant, and is the idea that you have, again, a set of primitives and components, and then the question is how do you compose those together to being able to do something. And in his case, particularly looking at the issues of precision. So I encourage you, most of you already have great thesis topics, but if you're looking for one and you want to explore this area, get in touch with Grandpa.
I didn't pay Mason. For that.
All right. Well, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Ken.
I'll pay you later.